right, good morning, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and get started here. My name is Matthew Prigge. I'm from Milwaukee, from the Ken Keltner chapter, and I'm going to be talking this morning about the spring training of 1995, known as the Replacement Player Spring Training. This is research that I'm doing that I hope to turn into a book. So this is really a work in progress, but I just wanted to bring this issue up today because I think the issue, just overall, the strike era of 94 to 95 is kind of an underexamined event in baseball history, and really, you know, I think the transformative figure of the last generation, transformative event of the last generation or so, and the spring training that followed that, the phenomenon of owners going to replacement players to try to counter the striking players union is something that is kind of remembered today, but really there's a lot of mythos and assumptions made about what went on that spring. So this project seeks to address really four questions. Why did the owners choose to proceed with replacement players? Who were these replacement players? How does this issue fit within the larger lens of American labor history? And then finally, what would the 1995 season have looked like if it had opened using replacements? So to start, to get to that, the first part of that, why this was done. So here we have August 94, the players go on strike. Obviously the World Series is canceled. There's a lot that's been written about, you know, the poison environment between the players union and the owners at that time. Obviously this is coming on, this is the next in terms of baseball labor history. The owners are on a pretty long losing streak at this point. They tried to counteract that in the 80s by entering into the collusion era. This was actually right around the same time they first began to advocate for a salary cap as well. So when the labor agreement expired at the end of the 93 season, it was virtually guaranteed that the 94 discussion was going to be very acrimonious between the players and the owners. I believe that the owners heading into the, you know, after the cancellation of the World Series, were using the 1987 NFL players' strike as a model for how they wanted to break the players' union. In 87, the NFL players went on strike in week four of the regular season. The owners had anticipated this. They had built up reserves of replacement players and were ready to go after missing just a week of game action. The NFL players union, with what the owners were calling a viable alternative to striking, that is, games to return to, began to crumble. By the end of 3 weeks of replacement player ball, about 15% of the NFL workforce had crossed the line. With that, the union gave up, and the object of the strike in 87 to achieve full free agency for football, NFL players, was not realized for another 5 years. And when it was, it came with a salary cap and with other limitations. So I think that, you know, this really not being that far before the 94-95 strike, this was the model that the MLB owners were trying to emulate, to give the striking players a viable alternative. So that gets to the question of, who were these replacement players? This is really the part of this is pretty straightforward. Part of it is actually quite complicated. So first, just to make clear who was on strike in 1995. The strike actually expanded as training camps opened in 1995. Of course, all players on every team's 40-man roster are members of the players union, but when the players went on strike in 94, it was only the 25-man active rosters of those players that stopped working. If you were on the 40-man roster and you were in the minor leagues, even though the union was on strike, you kept playing. So that the pool of striking players expands right as camp opens. The teams had made clear their intention to field replacement players in January, and they went about looking for people to fill these roles. Now, the concept of a replacement player, you know, who's actually meets that definition, is one of the things that I really wanted to look at in this. Very few players actually outed themselves as replacements. Oil Can Boy was probably the most prominent of these. He was, you know, he came into White Sox camp. He said, you know, without question, he was going to play during the regular season. He was going to cross the line. A lot of the building of these replacement rosters was kind of done in secret. These were essentially just non-roster invitees to camp. This was done by the teams and by the players themselves, too, to kind of protect them from what might be union backlash, undue media attention. So the pool of players were largely six-year minor league free agents, former major leaguers. The teams brought in a lot of players from foreign leagues. The Italian league had a lot of people who entered into, who were non-roster invitees in 95. The Braves even signed the catcher from the Russian national team. So heading into spring camp, basically you've got this pool of what the newspapers begin calling replacement profile players, and then players from the minor leagues who are not yet on the 40-man roster. Now, the definition or the popular conception of these replacement players at the time kind of fell into two camps. The first is, and this is how largely based on how they were presented by the media, the first is this concept of, you know, the working class hero type player. There you see a baseball card of Alexander Kogan, who was in Mets camp as a pitcher. And he, you know, really kind of fit this, he got some profile coverage in the media about just his background. He was a 37-year-old from the Bronx. You know, they said he talked like Tony Danza. He delivered appliances as his day job. And he got some write-ups for actually driving his appliance truck to the spring training site and saying, you know, oh, I got to pitch for the Mets and then go and deliver these refrigerators afterwards. So that was one, you know, way that the media kind of covered this. And the other was this concept of the replacement player as just completely incompetent. Pretty much every newspaper that covered a major league team ran a photo like this early on in camp of a non-roster invitee booting a ball or looking silly, striking out, or something like that. The idea that these were players who, you know, had no business being on a baseball field and were just, you know, way beyond their scope. But the reality of this kind of lands somewhere in between. These were largely fringe prospects, mid-tier pros who really never managed to, you know, to turn the corner and to make it happen professionally. And, you know, as I said, most of the players who showed up would not classify themselves as replacement players. A lot of them said that they had no intention of playing in the regular season, that they just wanted to get another look, get another shot, get into some games, and maybe, you know, find a spot in the minor leagues somewhere. Now, in early March of 95, just before the spring schedule was about to start, the Players Union makes a decree that throws a wrench into all these plans. They say that any player who appears in a spring training game to which admission is charged and is held at a major league facility is going to be considered a strike breaker. Prior to this, the owners had intended on using their minor leaguers as well as these replacement profile players in these games. So this accomplishes a couple of things for the Players Union. First of all, you know, it takes a swipe at ownership. Obviously, they're trying to make some money off of these spring games. And really, it reasserts their dominance over the pool of players that is in camp. It also, some people at the time saw this. I'm not quite sure I buy it. But it also takes aim at one player in particular, Michael Jordan, who some of you might have forgotten. Actually, he reported to spring training in 1995. He'd had a not-so-great season at AA in 94, but he played in the Arizona Fall League that year, and actually, you know, he improved his swing. He was looking like a ball player by the turn of 1995, and he reported to Sox camp. He'd said, declaratively that he was not going to cross the line, but he wanted to, you know, again, to get in his games and get a look. I think it was expected that he would start the season at AAA. But with this decree by the players' union, Jordan says that he will not, he's not going to cross the union. Now, with the with this coming down from the union, teams take one of two approaches to this. Some teams kind of soft pedal it. They say that anybody who does not want to participate in games doesn't have to. Other teams, Cincinnati was very hard line on this. They at first took the stance that no matter what the union says, everybody's going to play. That's why you're here. If not, you're going to get sent home. But, you know, most teams are kind of in the middle on that. And what the White Sox and a lot of other teams do is they actually divide their camp at the start of the spring schedule. You know, the players who are going to play go here. Anybody who's not goes to the minor league facility. And, you know, reading the accounts of the time, some people here might be more familiar with me than with the White Sox spring training facilities back then, but it really seemed like the, you know, the minor league side of things in Sarasota, where they were? Yeah, Sarasota was, you know, kind of folding chair and nail on the wall to hang your coat. Michael Jordan didn't particularly like that. He didn't particularly want to be in the, you know, decrepit barracks of the minor league half. So after the Sox camp splits, he leaves the team, eventually retires, obviously. I don't need to tell you what he does after this. So that you know, that happens all over the league. These teams split their camps, and it puts a lot of pressure on, you know, minor leaguers, especially again those, you know, mid-range guys who you know, might be 6 year or more vets with a team, or 6 year or more minor league veterans. Again, just trying to find a spot. It puts a lot of pressure on them to you know, to cross the line, to try to get their shot, or to be beholden to this union, which, you know, really in a lot of cases hasn't done much for them. So again, the concept of, you know, who these replacement players are is something that really surprised me in this research. There you've got four of, you know, what I've started to call the Wikipedia list of replacement players, particularly players who debuted in the major leagues after the spring of 1995. You know, I'm sure you could think of a few guys, you know, older players who, former major leaguers who were considered replacement players, but these four guys here, you know, you've heard the story. They're not allowed in the players' union. They can't appear in video games. You know, the champion, with the case of Damian Miller, you know, the championship stuff for the Diamondbacks, his name is excluded from that. But I found out that these four guys really, you know, kind of got a raw deal in that. Corey Liddell threw one inning for the Brewers in the spring of 95. Kerry Leitenberg, he was on the Mariners roster for a few days. He was one of those players that was told he would be sent home if he didn't play. Kevin Millar only appeared in a handful of games. Damian Miller played in one minor league, or one B game. These were all players who had no intention of playing in the regular season, and in a lot of cases were misled into appearing in games, being told it would not break the union's decree. One player, Billy McMillian, the Marlins outfielder, he actually got an at-bat in spring of 95 and was later led into the players' union, but he's the only one. So Rick Reed and Brendan Donnelly, these are the only, strike that, there's actually three players that I found so far who made the major leagues after spring of 95 and had intentions of actually playing as replacement players in the 95 season. The third that I didn't get to include here was Pete Rose Jr., who was going to be the leadoff man for your White Sox, had the season opened, and then later got couple weeks with the Reds. So even the, you know, the final opening day rosters of teams, of players who are going to cross the line during the regular season, even some of those are, you know, speculative as I'm trying to put this together. The teams really wanted to wait until the very last moment to declare who their players were going to be, because, you know, even though the union had made that decree that anybody playing in spring was going to be considered the same as someone who'd crossed in the regular season, people during the spring of 95 still saw a distinction between one or the other. A lot of the players who were, you know, replacement profile players who were participating in spring games, you know, they'd say that they were still undecided on playing in the regular season. Some would said that they, you know, outright that they would refuse to play during the regular season. So, you know, what we think of today as a replacement player was thought of much differently in 1995. So, I don't want to run out of time here, but just to quickly talk about the labor aspect of this, this is one area in which I'm not as far along in the research as other areas, but you know, this was a very odd labor event, just in how the, you know, the top echelon of the body of professional baseball players in the United States was, you know, exerting a lot of pressure on the least compensated of their members to, you know, to hold their own power. I also want to look at areas, you know, how the players' union fits into labor in general. A lot of people forget that the umpires were also on strike in the spring of 95. There was no, you know, crossover, no support from the players' union. Neither had they done that in previous occasions when the umpires' union went on strike. There was also, you know, this idea, again, going back to 87, this is the picture you see here. This is striking members of the Seahawks actually, you know, yelling at and belittling the replacements on a practice field. If you've seen some of the footage, you know, players, they were out there picketing. They, you can see footage of them throwing eggs and rocks at a bus of replacement players. The MLB union, they didn't have anything like that. There was one instance in early on in spring where, and I forget the specifics of this, but they made some comment about that they would not be picketing themselves for security purposes, but they were hoping that, you know, sympathetic labor members from other unions might do so, you know, on their behalf, which of course, you know, raised the, all the newspapers were talking about after that was that the, you know, the players union now had replacement picketers. So as a, you know, as a labor issue, this was, you know, quite odd. So then finally, what would the 1995 season have looked like? There were a handful of replacement games actually played at major league facilities. In fact, Coors Field, the first game they ever hosted, was the Rockies, the replacement Rockies and replacement Yankees. Dodger Stadium also hosted a replacement game. The Tigers and Braves played at Fulton County. The Cubs and Rangers played at the ballpark at Arlington. But had that season started, you know, they were, I think, 2 days away from opening the replacement season when Judge Sonia Sotomayor, now in the Supreme Court, obviously, issued that, ruled that the owners had been operating in bad faith and opened the door for the strike to end. Many of you may, you know, you might remember that the Orioles did not field a team at all in the spring of 95. There wasn't a real strong resolution on what was going to happen with them. I think the first week of games they were going to be involved in, they decided that those were going to be forfeits. But beyond that, they didn't really have much of a plan. The Blue Jays were going to end up playing at their spring training site in Florida, not allowed to field a replacement team in Toronto. The rosters themselves would have looked quite differently. This would have been an all-American-born league had they opened in 95. Obviously, you cannot get a work visa to work in the United States if you're going to be, you know, a strike breaker. A couple of the big names had they opened in 95, Boy Rodriguez, playing for the Pirates. He batted .480 in spring with 7 home runs. Luis De Leon, Mambo, some of you might remember him. He was called by the Sporting News the most valuable replacement player of the spring. He had a number of starts at a 1.17 ERA, kept his batting average against under 200. And then, if that can be read, just to speculate, because why miss an opportunity to speculate? These are the final standings from 95, spring training of 95, broken into divisions, just to give you an idea. Obviously, you know, spring training, notoriously a poor indicator of how teams might play in the regular season. This might have been a little different. I like to point this out because this is the only chance that the Brewers had to win a division in this 15-year period here. So there you see how things might have turned out. I think, just to wrap things up quickly, had the Marlins and Mets were going to open the replacement season in Florida on a Sunday night, had that first pitch been thrown in Florida, I think you would have seen at least a month of replacement ball, because the contracts they had signed basically guaranteed them all their first month's pay, roster bonuses, severance bonus, as soon as the season opened. So by that point, the owners would have had a few million dollars invested in this and really no reason to go back to any kind of negotiations. So that's where I am with replacement, the replacement spring of 1995. If anybody has any questions, we got a few minutes left. Thank you. Yes.
Yes, thank you. You referred to the owners wanting to break the union, but beyond that, I wonder, do we know, and if so, how do we know, exactly what sort of structure of the game the owners were hoping to come out of this confrontation?
Well, we got a good taste of that. Actually, for, I think, 3 weeks in January or February, they unilaterally imposed a salary cap system. And the game kind of, the union wasn't letting anybody sign, but there were deals in place that would have, I think after 4 years, you had a kind of restricted free agency. It got rid of arbitration, imposed cap based on the previous year's.
I'm sorry, what did you say about free agency?
That would have been, if you had four, after four seasons, you'd be a restricted free agent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and there were, I mean, Sammy Sosa was ready to go to the Red Sox, had that come into place. There were a number of guys ready to go. So, I mean, we have a clear idea of what they wanted to do.
And, okay.
You know, that was one of the things that got batted down by the courts after a while, but it kind of existed for a while.
Thanks.
Yeah.
A quote and a question. The quote I can't remember exactly, but it was Tony La Russa in the spring training of 95. I don't know if you've come across this, when he said, "I wish my regular players could be here so they could remember what it was like when they loved to play baseball."
Yeah.
The question is this. You mentioned kind of that the media liked showing these guys bobbling balls and stuff early. My recollection, which maybe, you know, it's 30 years almost, was that as they got closer and closer to the regular season, both the sports writers and the announcers started showing more respect to these guys, that it was more like, instead of, yeah, here goes another error, is more like, well, you know, this guy would probably be marginal. You know, they were more looking at more like, here are real players doing real things, which made sense because it was getting close to the season. But I wondered what your thoughts were on that.
By the time that the season was about to start, there were still a lot of people who wanted nothing to do with it. But, you know, they had earned a kind of respect, you know, as ball players, and they got very, you know, sympathetic write-ups when the strike ended, and they all had to... Pretty much all of the replacement profile guys were sent home after that. A few of them, you know, the people who did make the majors after that were mostly the minor leaguers or people who were, you know, on the fence about actually crossing when the season started.
Yeah, I mean, the Cubs and White Sox both signed a few of their guys to the minors, which I guess created some tension with the minor leaguers who hadn't crossed the line.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Thanks.
So we have one more.
Okay, last question. Just looking at your chart here, what happened to the Orioles that they didn't play any games, it looks like?
Oh, yeah. So
I wanted to hear about that.
Yeah. So Peter Angelos, owner of the Orioles, he made his money as a labor lawyer. So he was not going to – he was always, you know, the one vote against all this. Also, Cal Ripken's streak was a big part of that. There was, you know, thought, if this season starts, does this streak end? You know, if they just don't play, does it keep going? And oddly enough, the schedule as it was set prior to the strike wiping out the first month of the season would have actually had him bring that record on the road in Oakland, I think, which is, I don't know how the schedule makers would have screwed up something that badly. But so it was actually the strike that had that great, you know, that produced that great moment in Baltimore, because otherwise it would have been, it would have been fun, but it would have been in Oakland.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.